From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. Not long ago, it was the kind of place everyone wanted to work. The archetypal 21st century startup. Ping pong table, nap pods, awesome group outings to the indoor skydiving center, free massages, a kitchen seemingly stocked with endless beer and snacks. But once the shine rubs off, you often find a workplace that's instead defined by long hours, low diversity, no job security, and very high anxiety. That's because Big Brother, or in this case, Big Investor, is watching you, and if you fail, you're out. Well, author Dan Lyons says that the toxic work culture of Silicon Valley is flooding offices pretty much everywhere now, making us all, whether we like it or not, workplace lab rats. This hour On Point, how Silicon Valley made work miserable for the rest of us. And join us. Is this your story? Have your managers tried out the latest new organizational behavior theory on you? Did it work? Did it make you more productive or happier? Or despite the bright colors and cool perks, are you more anxious and less happy, less empowered at work than you were before? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us now in the studio is Dan Lyons. He's author of the new book, Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. We have an excerpt of that book at onpointradio.org. Dan was also a former staff writer at the Emmy-winning HBO series Silicon Valley and a former editor at Newsweek. Dan Lyons, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so I want to start where you start this book with a great example. And you talk about Legos. How is it that Legos are indicative of Silicon Valley ruining the workplace?
Well, yeah, you have to draw a line from one to the other.
Because everybody loves Legos, you know.
Everybody loves Legos. And I just didn't realize that Legos were now a workplace thing. And a lot of people I've talked to about this were equally surprised. So I was actually interviewing someone about Agile, which is this new workplace methodology that's become almost a religion. And we were talking about that. And in the course of that conversation, the guy said, oh, no, you've got to talk to the Lego people. And I said, who are the Lego people? And he said, oh, you can pay $3,000 or $5,000 and become a certified Lego trainer. And then you can go sell engagements to corporations. You can make a fortune running Lego workshops. And I'm like, what is that? I thought he was joking, right? And he's like, no, it's a real thing. And I ended up meeting a Lego trainer and spending half a day with her. And I played little Lego games. And it's sort of this there's this whole school of Lego thinking called Lego Serious Play with a little trademark after it. And you can't use that unless you're, you know, an official Lego Serious Play person. There's a whole industry of Lego trainers. It's such a big little world that it's had a schism. You know, and there's like a fork and there's like the real Lego. It's like the people Judean front and the Judean people's front. It's like, no, those are the wrong Lego people. We do the right Lego. And yeah, they go into corporations and they run these Lego workshops.
Well, we actually have a clip from a video of by the organization Project Play, which runs some of these workshops.
Yeah.
On Lego Serious Play, this team-building method designed to boost group communication, as Dan Lyons has been saying, using Legos.
Yeah.
We might ask the question like, what are your strengths or what are you afraid of? And it's amazing to see what people come up with in their field, as well as the answers that they're able to share. We've actually had people cry in the workshop because they realize something deeper about their challenge or something deeper about what they fear. So we love the Lego Serious Play method, and we think it's a great way to look at brainstorming sessions and creating more synergy amongst the team.
That's a video from the organization Project Play. I mean, look, Dan Lyons, I love Legos. I don't know anyone who doesn't love Legos, but the idea that this is an interesting tool that can help you be more creative or realize things about yourself in the workplace, I don't know, maybe I'm reading this wrong. It doesn't seem all that far-fetched. So what's the problem?
Right. I mean, and that's the thing. I went into this meeting with this woman somewhat cynical and feeling silly and self-conscious. And then as I write in the chapter, I did one exercise with this woman. And it's a very classic one. It's called Make a Duck. You get six Lego pieces. Yeah. They dump them out on the table. I forget which shape they are. And make a duck. You have 30 seconds.
A three-year-old's like done like that, though.
Right. And I sat there freaking out. I couldn't figure out how to use all six. I could only use four. Finally, time was up, and I said, I only have four. And I will tell you this. That 30 seconds gutted me like a fish. It absolutely cut to the core of my psyche. She was right, because everything. And so I said, "I'm sorry." And she says, "Why are you apologizing?" I said, "Well, I couldn't use all six." She said, "Who said you had to use all six? I just said make a duck." And I'm like, "Oh, so it's one of those trick questions, right?" But then I thought, "But why was that my response? Why was my response when I did this to be afraid? I'm going to do it wrong. I'm not going to be smart enough. This is secretly an IQ test, and I'm failing, right? A child could do this, and I can't. It's like a Rubik's cube," which was all about entirely. Yeah, it was like the person that in that clip talking about crying. It was like, "Oh, that is the mistake I've made at work. I'm always afraid of being fired and failing, right?"
So this sounds great, powerful.
It sounds great.
Maybe it helped you realize that you have a high degree of performance anxiety
as
an employee. So what's the problem here? Why is this indicative of the Silicon Valley trends ruining work for everybody else?
This really didn't originate in Silicon Valley.
Okay.
But it's very popular at Google. It's part of agile training, which does originate in Silicon Valley, and it goes along with things like playing with Play-Doh, playing with tennis balls, wearing silly hats, and having different roles. And maybe it's all useful, but there seems to me to be a kind of infantilization of the workplace that goes along with this. But another aspect of it that really freaks me out a little bit is that it's giving your employer permission to sort of do a psychoanalysis of you and creep into your brain in a way where, like, we worry about our privacy, but we don't worry about this. And I think my theory is that if I were a worker of a certain age, as I am, that this would be a stressful thing. It might not be a cathartic thing. It might be really stressful. I think you're going to go in thinking, A, if I put up my hand and say this is stupid and silly and I don't want to do it, you'll be in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in
the process of researching and writing this book, though, did you – because there have been lots of microscopic analyses of the toxicity of Silicon Valley culture, you know, the bro culture, the misogyny, the racism, you write about some of these things, and also the vast amounts of money and how that skews behavior, the obsession with hyperproductivity. Lots of discussion about this over the many years. I'm just wondering, what are the particular aspects of Silicon Valley culture that you see bleeding into? Because the subtitle of your work is Making It Miserable for the Rest of Us. So what's bleeding into American work culture more broadly?
Right. And I should say that I opened with that Lego anecdote mostly because I thought it was funny, and I could write it in a funny way, sort of like that the Silicon Valley show.
It got me thinking about how I might make a duck out of six Legos. I'll be honest.
So, but it's not really the core argument of the book. But I think there's several ways. All the things you just mentioned are part of it, and I think since about 2000, a different kind of person has taken hold in Silicon Valley. The industry almost has been hijacked by a new kind of venture capitalist and a new kind of founder. And they're sort of Ayn Rand libertarians. They believe in shareholder capitalism, but in an extreme. They aren't necessarily trying to build companies that last forever. They espouse a new contract with labor that says you should have no job security. You're going to get fired probably after a year, year and a half, and you're just going to keep changing jobs. And you shouldn't be upset about that. And you work long hours under a great deal of stress. An executive at Uber once described their culture as compared it to the way diamonds are made, that you take carbon and you put it under tremendous, tremendous pressure for millions and billions of years, but it produces a diamond. And I thought, that does not sound like where I want to work. And he said, and you know, a lot of people can't take it here at Uber, but the ones who do are diamonds, and now they can go on to other jobs. So yeah, that is the culture there. It's spreading because in the last 20 years, as that's been happening, Silicon Valley has become much more influential across the culture. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Vanity Fair list of most important and most influential people, it used to be mostly media and celebrities, and now it's really skewed toward techies. They really exert a tremendous influence across the culture. They also have become a bigger part of the economy.
Right. Just
they make up the top of the Fortune 500. And so you see other older companies trying to learn from them, partly out of fear, their fear of being disrupted. And so they go to Silicon Valley and they set up labs or incubators or you know, they think that if they can just physically be there, they can grab some of this magic, whatever it is, and then bring it back into their bloodstream. Or they send executives out on these things called Silicon Safaris where they—
Silicon Safaris. Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. That, well, that's what they call them in Silicon Valley because you're sitting there, you're a startup, and they, oh, here's another group of like dorks from, you know, somewhere who are on a van literally going from, you know, startup to startup to startup, and they come in and they watch you like zoo animals, and maybe you have to take a break and talk to them. VCs have like little operations where they just accommodate these safari people and, you know, talk to them. And
in order to learn how business is done in these companies?
Silicon Valley. Yeah. How do they see the world? I mean, there are actually tour operators that have sprung up to make money by running Silicon Safaris. It's become an industry unto itself. So you have people coming there trying to learn from these guys. And I'm like, but everything you're learning seems really bad to me. You know, I met with a group of German businessmen who were on a safari in San Francisco, and it was right as the Uber thing was blowing up with Susan Fowler and all this terrible stuff. And they were, you know, older. They were my age, maybe a little younger. All men, you know, and they were all from non-tech industries.
Yeah.
And they were. It was the last night of their thing, and we were having dinner, and then they had a few drinks, and we kind of loosened up, and I was saying, what do you possibly have to learn from these people? And they all were just kind of laughing. They were all just kind of amused by Silicon Valley.
They were amused, but not necessarily convinced. But
yes.
Okay, so we're going to come back here in just a minute. We're talking with Dan Lyons. He's author of the new book, Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. And we want to hear from you. Have you seen your workplace change in the last 10, 15 20 years? Do you feel like you're the sort of the result of an experiment, the latest new fad in terms of organizational behavior and how to run a corporation that maybe came out of Silicon Valley? Is it making you better and more productive? Is it making you happier or less? We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Dan Lyons. He's author of the new book, Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. Dan also happened to be a staff writer on the Emmy-winning HBO series Silicon Valley and a former editor at Newsweek. And we have a cut here from the pilot episode of Silicon Valley. Dan was not a writer on the show at this time, but this is from the pilot episode where Richard Hendricks, played by Thomas Middleditch, winds up in the doctor's office when he's faced with a really stress-inducing decision whether or not to sell his company for $10 million or keep ownership of the startup he created for a lower price. So in this clip, you hear Richard speaking to his doctor.
So, you will survive. It's just a garden variety panic attack. Welcome to Silicon Valley. We see people like you all the time.
Really?
Yes.
Let's just have to make this decision by tomorrow.
Yeah. You know, a while back, we had a guy in here in almost the exact same situation. Take the money or keep the company.
What happened?
Well, a couple months later, he was brought into the ER with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. I guess he really regretted not taking that money.
A little black humor there about the pressures that Silicon Valley execs may face. But in reality, things can get a little strange and most definitely uncomfortable, if not out and out inappropriate. Because in this next cut, you're going to hear Bloomberg anchor Emily Chang diving into the frat-like world of Silicon Valley. She did that in her book Brotopia, which was published earlier this year. And she told Business Insider in February about the shocking details of some tech women's day-to-day lives.
I don't want to get into a hot tub and pitch investors my business while holding a beer. What woman wants to do that while wearing a bikini? And these things are really happening.
So that's Emily Chang talking about one of the things that may happen or does happen in Silicon Valley. Now, look, Dan Lyons, the thing about your book that I think is the deepest point that you make is how Silicon Valley views its actual employees and actual workers. Tell me more about that, because part of what you wrote seems very familiar to me in terms of how industrialists of old also saw their workers.
Right. Only I think it's actually even worse. So the view today in Silicon Valley is that workers are essentially disposable widgets. They're fuel. They're like the coal you throw in a steam engine to keep it going. So you hire them, you burn them out, churn them out, and just hire again. And you just high turnover and high burnout. Oddly enough, it's counter to what Silicon Valley was even as recently as when I started writing about Silicon Valley in the late 80s. At that time, the gold standard was something called the HP way,
right,
which was really human-centric, really employee-centric. It was a great place to work and to stay.
Talking about Hewlett-Packard, right.
Hewlett-Packard. And then
Bill Hewitt and Dave Packard, right? They had a whole management theory about management by walking around. They used to profit share quite a bit with their employees. I mean, it was the standard of look, it would turn into a blue chip company. I mean, no longer, but it was at the top of the heap once. The garage that Bill and Dave founded HP in is a national landmark.
Right. And the one thing I loved about it too, they would have a big picnic for the whole company once a year, and your families, and they viewed the company as a family, and the two of them would serve all the hamburgers. You know, they would sort of serve people. It was sort of symbolic, but you know, there's a certain humility to it, and they wanted people to stay for their entire careers. They bought land for employees to go camping in or, you know, for recreation in different parts of the world where they had offices. They were really very much about the people in their country. Then the next wave in the 70s and 80s, you had this sort of countercultural wave where you had like the Jobs and Wozniak kind of thing. And when I came into covering tech in the late 80s, it was still kind of hippy-dippy, countercultural, pro-people. It was a great place to work. If you landed a job at one of these places, it was like, oh, fantastic. And that has radically changed. That's no longer, you know, that kind of place. It's very stressful.
Yeah. Well, Dan, can I just come jump in here a second? Because we've got a caller who's talking exactly this about the value of employees in this day and age. So let me just get his say here. Mm. Robert is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Robert, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, I was saying that the value of an employee is the same value as that of an electric lamp. You're transactional. If you can be turned on and used, fine, but if not, discard. And it's nothing new. We're just returning back to form, back to the old capitalism of the robber baron. And it's the way things are unless you're willing to make a change.
Robert, thank you so much for your call. Dan Lyons, what do you think about that? I mean, he's kind of saying what I had said earlier, that a lot of this sounds really familiar.
It does in a way, except I went back and thought, I'm going to read books by industrialists of a previous generation and see what they thought. So I read Henry Ford's memoirs and I read Thomas Watson Jr., who was the CEO of IBM, and Lee Iacocca. So it's not the robber barons, but and Henry Ford obviously was not a nice guy.
Yeah.
You get to the very end of his memoirs and there's the last chapter and you're like,
Oh
my God, like you just, whoa. But before that part, though, it's amazing. He's saying, I am doing this to try to create as many jobs for as many human beings as I can and to treat them really well. He, at one point, had his staff go around and try to find jobs that disabled people could do because those people are pushed out of the workforce. Find me all the jobs you could do if you only had one arm. Find me all the jobs you could do if you were blind. Make a list, and then we're going to go hire those people so they can work and they can make a living.
Yeah, but this is the key difference, though, right? That there was a time, not for every company, but for many companies, the point was to grow the company, and doing so involved trying to be the best employer they could be. But you know, sometime in the 70s and 80s, American capitalism turned over to shareholder value creation, that was the ultimate goal of the company, to serve the interests of shareholders. So when that and I guess what I'm wondering is, in your book, are you writing that you think that Silicon Valley, because it's full of all of some of these billion-dollar valued companies that may or may not be turning a profit, that essentially they've put all the shareholder value creation like on hyperspeed, that it is is by far the most important thing of anything that these companies can do. And that's the pernicious thing. Is that
yes.
what you're saying?
Okay. Yes, it's hyper-capitalism. Yeah. It's – you have 1970. The turning point is Milton Friedman publishes his famous essay about shareholder capitalism. And every CEO goes, this is great. All I have to do is return money to investors, tie my own compensation to the stock price, and anything I can do to make that happen is great. Gut the pension fund. You know, it usually all involves hurting employees. And but so you had four stakeholders. You had customers, employees, the community, and investors. And Milton Friedman just said, well, investors come first. Now it's investors that are the only ones who matter. So you have companies in Silicon Valley that, yeah, have run for years, have never made a profit, don't treat their employees well, deliver what they call MVP, minimum viable product, dodge taxes. Look at Apple and Google, you know, hiding all this money offshore and not paying taxes, all to benefit investors. You have companies where VCs have become fabulously rich, founders have become fabulously rich, but the company itself
is not profitable necessarily.
Yeah, and so it can't treat its employees very well. So it's a really inside out kind of version of capitalism.
Okay. Well, yeah. let's get another call here. We're speaking with Dan Lyons. He's author of Lab Rats: How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. Marge is calling from Lebanon, Connecticut. Marge, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. I want to say that I worked for a large insurance company in Hartford, Connecticut for 36 years. My father also retired from this company. He worked there 40 years. All the time I was growing up, I do not remember him working overtime. He was home at 5 o'clock for supper every day. We had weekends to go away and so forth. Now, the 12 years I worked in a wonderful unit, I was able to accomplish every project they gave to me on time or before target date. Then they rearranged things. The 5 years before I retired, I retired 4 years ago, but 5 years before I retired, they reorganized, and I became so overloaded with work, and I had to support many times more units than I used to support, and I could not sleep at night. You know, I had stuff on my desk a year that I was not able to touch, and new stuff constantly being dropped on, you know, on my lap. And yet the manager would say, well, you know, there has to be a work-life balance. But people were working around me 60-hour weeks with no extra pay. They were salaried, paid for 40 hours. I was getting emails from supervisors at 10 o'clock at night, on weekends. I mean, it was really getting quite unbearable. And I retired earlier than I might have if it had been like my prior unit, which was able, you were able to accomplish what you were given.
Yeah. Marge, thank you so much for your call. And I'm sorry to hear about the experience that you had there at work, but I appreciate you sharing your story, Marge. Thank you so much. Dan Lyons, hang on here for just a second because I want to bring in another person into this conversation. Ania Williams joins us now. She's joining us from San Francisco, California. She's co-founder of Zebras Unite, an organization that calls for a more ethical and inclusive startup and venture capital culture. She's also executive director of Black and Brown Founders, an organization dedicated to helping Black and Latinx tech entrepreneurs. Ania Williams, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me. Hi, Meghna.
Hi.
Hi, Dan.
It's really great to have you, Ania, because you're still in the middle of all, very much in the middle of this entire culture that we've been talking about this hour so far. I mean, first of all, how accurate do you think Dan Lyons' conception or representation of Silicon Valley work culture is?
I think it's incredibly accurate. It's bittersweet. I think in a lot of ways, it can feel a little bit dismal and doomsday, as can many things around us these days. But there are some great opportunities. I think that there is a lot that the technology industry in Silicon Valley has a lot that the world can learn from. There's also a lot of things that I think we should just totally throw in the trash. I think some of the listening to you guys talk about the things that you have already, you guys are definitely hitting the nail on the head.
Yeah. So just let me ask you about, I want to hear some examples for you in a second, Ania, but to be totally fair, Dan made a point earlier about Silicon Valley's, or I should say tech culture more broadly, because Amazon's a big one here, not necessarily located in Silicon Valley, but it's cultural influence. Now, one of the reasons why these practices may be so influential is because these are the biggest companies in America, if not the world right now. Their founders are incredibly influential. They're cultural heroes, cultural icons, and they're celebrating a kind of approach to work where perhaps a lot of people can't hack it, but the people who do are creating the products and ways of being of the future. So, you know, a lot of people might hear this and say, what's wrong with that? They're the winners, you know?
Right. Well, I think one of the big issues is about how we think about extracting value from the world around us. And if we're looking at the bad side of it, when you look at some of the biggest tech companies, which also happen to be some of the biggest companies in the world right now, they tend to extract value and from the world and from the environment and from the ecosystem in ways that they don't give it back. And I think that that's fundamentally wrong. And really, there needs to be a better balance there. I think, you know, a really great example, since you mentioned Amazon, would be that we all now know that Jeff Bezos is the richest person on the planet. What's his value? He's valued at $150 billion of net worth or something like that, where people, you know, up until they literally just in the last month raised their minimum wage to $15 an hour, there were people working for him that were on welfare. Like, that's fundamentally wrong and unbalanced.
Yeah, well, so we actually have some tape here of an Amazon employee. You're about to hear Vicky Shannon Allen. She injured her back last year while processing items for shipment at an Amazon warehouse outside of Dallas. She had a dispute with Amazon over workers' compensation. She ended up homeless and sleeping in her car in the Amazon parking lot. She spoke to Jolene Kent on NBC News in September.
What should a customer know out there when they're clicking to buy something to have it delivered to their home?
They should know that that's our blood, sweat, and tears that's going into that. That's my back. That's somebody else's arm. That's somebody's life.
That's Vicky Shannon Allen, a former Amazon warehouse employee. Anea Williams, you are co-founder of Zebras Unite, and you're calling for a more ethical and inclusive culture in Silicon Valley. What does that look like? What specifically are you aiming for and trying to grow?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, and just that clip is heartbreaking. Oh my gosh, I felt that. Yeah. I don't want to harp too much on the Amazon thing before I answer that question. Is that, you know, it all really comes back to awareness and intentionality. Because when we think about Amazon, like, I use Amazon a lot. And it has now become this staple and this thing that I'm dependent on. I use, you know, Uber or Lyft a lot. There's a lot of things that they have done to streamline or make our lives easier that we feel like we now can't do without, or our society has actually started to form around these things. And it's hard for us to make a different alternate choice and expect that we can live somewhat normal lives. So when you take the fact that, okay, they've created an incredibly, like, useful, sticky, valuable product, it comes back to what you guys were talking about earlier, like the thing that is driving the people at the very top, the people that get to make decisions, and that right now is very much driven by shareholders and profits.
Yeah.
When we think about having an alternative, like, way and thinking about an alternative culture and how we can build businesses, that's where Zebras comes in. So to your point, I think that we think about things in terms of, you know, building a counterpoint to startup culture and to tech culture that's more structured around win-win versus zero-sum,
okay,
or cooperation versus competition,
yeah,
or instead of, you know, instead of exits, it's more about sustainability. Instead of hoarding, it's more about sharing.
Well, we're gonna take a break here in just a minute, and I want to talk to you more about how the win-win works in an environment that is so competitive as Silicon Valley is. But Dan Lyons, we just got a minute here before the break. Oh. What do you think about what people like, what Anea and people like her are trying to do in Silicon Valley?
Oh, they are absolutely the ray of hope in this whole industry. And my last chapter is about them because I'm so impressed by what they're doing. And there are others. There is a fringe – I call it a fringe. There is a movement pushing back against this Silicon Valley business model, let's say. And they are – there is hope there. Yeah. And these guys – are a big part of it.
Well, we're talking with Dan Lyons. He's author of Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. Anea Williams is also with us this hour, joining us from San Francisco. She's co-founder of Zebras Unite, an organization that calls for more ethical and inclusive startup and venture capital culture. And we want to hear from you. Do you think the workplace practices and ethos of big Silicon Valley companies is spreading into your work, wherever you are in America? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? We'll have a lot more when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Dan Lyons. He's author of the new book, Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. And also joining us today from San Francisco is Anea Williams. She's co-founder of Zebras Unite, an organization that's calling for more ethical and inclusive startup and venture capital culture. And Anea and Dan, so many comments coming in online here. We have, for example, Toy Yoda is saying that, in my experience, what makes work life miserable isn't Google, but the dogma of workflow innovation that the software industry keeps inventing. Let's see. AC says, I've seen a slightly positive change in that we're moving towards open cubes and collaborative workspaces, but not much else yet. And Victoria Morrison on Twitter is saying, real Dan Lyons is making a good point here. I know some post-millennials and young people who reject current tech culture. Will they reinvent it or find another way to make a living? Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Dan, I have to take issue with some of the things that your perspective, and I'll give you my own background. I worked 15 years for Intel. A good portion of that time I was actually working in their VC arm, investing in companies in Israel. And then I left Intel, and I work now doing what you call safaris in Israel, that taking people around the world and showing them what's going on in Israel. And my perspective is that most of the companies that I'm in touch with, in my experience when I was doing some investing, was that the best companies and the most successful companies were the ones who really put the emphasis on the employees, because basically the startup culture, the tech culture, is grounded in knowledge, in bringing brain power, bringing innovation, bringing ideas.
The human capital.
And that's the human capital. And the ones who invest in that, and the best ones do invest in it, do well. And my experience is that the people who are working in those environments are energized and incentivized and compensated and enjoy it and feel like they're actually making a contribution.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for your call. Let's get Dan's response here.
No, I think he and I are completely in agreement. I think there are companies doing that, and those people are happy. But let's say Uber, and we can see everything that came out of Uber in the last couple of years is not like that, right?
Right.
Amazon warehouses are not like that. When he mentioned working in Israel, one of the best stories I came across in the last couple of years was an Israeli startup guy who was so desperate to raise money that he offered to give up one of his kidneys if anyone would give him $500,000 to buy a stake in his company. And it's a true story. And I thought, like, what have we come to? And even the VCs I called said, that is the most dystopian thing I've ever heard, right? And, I mean, it was maybe kind of a publicity stunt. And anyway, but, yeah, there is a lot of dystopian stuff out there, too.
Yeah. Well, Ania, so let me just ask you briefly, are we – because we've talked a lot about Amazon, Google, Facebook, I mean, are we Uber, are we overweighting the influence of these, like, the ultra big Silicon Valley companies? Or does, you know, it's because Steve was saying that not every company is going this way. Are there actually maybe medium or smaller size tech companies that are doing a better job that we should actually be focusing on instead?
Absolutely. There definitely are. I think it's really hard to shift that narrative from the biggest tech companies because they have so much influence over our economy as a whole.
Yeah.
I think the really interesting thing, too, that I want to touch on that gentleman's comment is that, you know, we're really ushering in this age of knowledge work. And we're approaching it in that very industrial mindset that was that turn of the century kind of way that we thought about working. And, you know, we have a lot. Again, it's always a little bit of the bitter with the sweet. Like, we're all excited to have the devices that are at our fingertips all the time. They let us do so much. But at the same time, productivity is like through the roof in some ways. And now expectations from workers are completely unrealistic and out of control.
Right. Now, isn't this ironic, yeah, though? Because with knowledge work, the asset is the worker, right?
Exactly.
It's not, workers are not the liability. Whereas sort of the standard way of looking at labor is that's the lever that as a manager or as a CEO that you can pull up and down most quickly in order to massage profits for that quarter, right? Just cut a workforce you make money. But in this case, we're talking about like the true assets of a company are the workers themselves. So my question to you, Ania, is that in trying to shift perspective a little here, mm-hmm, for these tech companies and for any business in America right now, like, how do you make that pitch that you focus more on workers, you make life better for workers, empower them more, that will actually produce longer term profits, but it's slower work? I mean, how do you make that pitch in an environment where those quarterly returns are so pressing?
Yeah, I think it has to come probably a bit from the top down, but some from the ground up. So I mentioned earlier, you know, awareness and intentionality are kind of the two things that keep coming up for me. So a couple examples of some tech startups that people have been talking a lot about. And interestingly enough, these are companies that may or may not be venture funded. So like actually MailChimp is an example of one that has been in the news recently. They're completely bootstrapped, so they never raised any venture capital. They're valued at, I think, $4 billion as a company now. And they have two owners. They're based in Atlanta. They're not even based in Silicon Valley. I know a few people that work there. I know that they have very generous benefits. They have very, like, they're very generous with their policies with people. They have a profit sharing policy. So I think when we think about like some of the ways in which we can look at, you know, structurally how a startup or how a tech company is formed and how we want to think differently about it, to me, it comes down to like alternative ways of thinking about financing those, yeah, startups. I think it's about alternative ways of thinking of corporate structures. And I think it's alternative ways of thinking about the culture around it. So some examples of that would be, you know, have radical transparency within your company and sometimes even with the outside, you know, external forces, and as much as you can be transparent with them. So Buffer is an example of a tech company that is radically transparent. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they share, it's a private company, but they share all of their numbers with the public. And they've told an entire story of actually how they just recently bought back their ownership of the company from their investors because they wanted to be able to build it more sustainably. And they weren't happy with the way that the way they were beholden to their investors was driving them to do things that they felt like were unhealthy for their company and, yeah, unhealthy for the people working there. Huh. And then I'd also say, like, again, companies that are doing profit sharing models or building them in kind of a more co-op style of model where people really want the employees to be able to participate in the success of that company as well. So everyone is invested in the success of it and everyone gets to reap the rewards instead of just a few people at the top. I think there's a lot to be said about having those more flexible schedules and, you know, enabling remote work. I know from my team, or I should say multiple teams because I run a few different things, you know, we tend to be really focused on the deliverables and we plan those together.
Right.
So it's around, okay, here's the timeline we've all set together. Here are the things that we need to deliver by this time. I don't care if you want to work like at 2 in the morning. I don't care if you want to work at 2 in the afternoon. I don't care if you want to go to the movies for the entire day and maybe you only work 3 days out of the week. Like,
just hit
as
the,
long as
hit
the work
goal
gets
the,
done.
Yeah, hit the goal in the best way for you.
Yeah, do what you have to do and live your life.
Now there are a lot more callers I want to get to here. But Dan, quick thought from you on what you're hearing from Ania.
Oh, yeah, we totally agree. And there's another company called Basecamp that is in Chicago, software company.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of detecting a few common threads with the other companies that you're talking about, Ania. And that is, one, Basecamp never took any VC. Two, they're not really obsessed with hyper growth or growing at any incredible rate. They believe in slow growth. They are profitable. They charge money for their software and they make a profit. They have no interest in going public. They want nothing to do with Wall Street. And when I look through another list of companies that have perennially been on the Fortune magazine best places to work list, there are, I think, 12 of them that have been on every year for 20 years. A lot of them are family owned. Many of them are not public, so you're not beholden to Wall Street. So if you can kind of opt out of that funding model, both the VC and the public markets on the other end of it, it seems like you can control your own destiny, which is what Zebra's. Ania, if I'm right, you guys are also talking about the fact that the VC industry is not set up to fund a company where you go in and say, we want to be small, sustainable, turn a profit, grow slowly, and treat our employees well. And the VCs kind of go, sorry, that's not what
we're business.
Yeah, they
would get up and walk away.
Yeah, that's not their thing. And so you need
not interested.
So what we really need is a new kind of funder. We need a new kind of source of money that is able to say, I will put money into your company and grow it slowly and sustainably.
Well, let's go to some callers here. Michael is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Michael, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just had a kind of an interesting perspective. I work in the landscape industry, so I wear a project manager hat. I design as well as sell. And the industry I work in is shifting from a interpersonal relationship oriented to more of a customer service management online modified platforms with apps such as Landscape Management Network and Dynascape. So as we shift, it is very difficult for us to manage how we change from the style of measuring input to output ratios and performance to effort, which is a very scientific, old-school, turn-of-the-century management style, and change with the times. And I certainly feel the pressure as a young person in a very older, dominated, family-operated and oriented service sector, that pressure day in and day out to achieve our maximum profitability while also managing our clients online, while also managing, and this is another layer, managing interpersonal communication with people that utilize English as a second language.
Yeah.
You know, how do you put that on a computer? How do you say, oh, it's going to snow today, I can't come do your job?
And you know, how are you handling it, Michael? I mean, that's multiple layers that you're talking about the things that you have to balance here. How are you handling it?
I mean, we change on a dime. So me, because I'm probably more right brain, left brain, I'm perfect for the job because I can, you know, change in and out. But I can't always be analytical. I also have to be creative. You know, when you're speaking with someone who speaks English as a second language, and certainly this time of year is worried about going back to possibly Mexico if they're on a visa or a green card application, and they're worried about how their family back home is doing, you know, these layers permeate us. And that doesn't equate to a effort to performance model that can be monetized on a computer screen to show an upper management level, hey, this is where we made profit.
Right.
These employees, if they're working in the rain, they work slower. I mean, that just seems like it's common sense, but you can't write that code into a computer. They want to know, well, how much slower? Is it 25% slower? We don't know. These are the kinds of things where I feel like Silicon Valley is doing a great job helping us become more technology-oriented as a universal industry to perform for our customers, but does a horrible job at the expense of human capital.
Right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your call. What an interesting example from the world of landscaping here. Before we run out of too much time, I want to get another call in here. Gail is calling from Portland, Maine. Gail, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I absolutely agree with Michael. I've been in the workforce a long time, worked for large very large international corporations and very small corporations. And what I've seen is this shift in two of my most recent employers, and I'm not in the tech industry, is that they've gone to what I consider to be management by absentia. And that is, I'm a feet on the street person, and I'm given a GPS tracker, and through our management software, you have to log in X amount of calls a day, what time you've been there, what you talked about. Then on top of that, because I don't have a direct manager, I have several, each one of them will layer on tasks that I have to complete before a certain deadline. And all of those things go toward making my quarterly bonuses, which is absolutely unachievable because of the inability to achieve all the tasks.
Yeah.
And I'm not the only one who sees that. So it's demoralizing because you know that you'll never get there. And management, when I started out in my career, was very involved on a daily basis. What are you doing? Who are you calling on? Let's solve this together. I don't have that. And my second part was, we have such low unemployment, and I gotta wonder if this treatment of professionals and knowledge being sidelined and not respected, but certainly not valued like I feel it used to be. I mean, we have other options. There's other places to go, and that kind of imperils where management is coming from. They just don't seem to be aware of that.
Right. So, Gail, thank you so much for your call. Dan Lyons, do you think Gail's on to something that maybe, you know, maybe people can move around until they find a job that treats them better, and could that be a source of change?
Right now, with employment the way it is, yes. And I have to say, Gail, that was horrifying what you just described. And I have a line in my book where I say, in the 80s, it felt like we used technology. Everybody got a PC, and you had Lotus 1-2-3, and you could do your work a little faster. And now I feel like technology uses us. That, you know, when you describe that system of all the things you have to do, and it's like, why? My boss is now a piece of software. If you're an Uber driver, literally, your boss is an algorithm, right? You work for an algorithm. And, you know, I think when you mentioned the economy, there's not a coincidence that after the crash of 2008 is suddenly also when the gig economy takes off, because
yeah.
You had all these people that you could sort of treat really poorly, not give them benefits, not make them employees, and they would take it. Maybe that will change if employment stays high. But yeah, that's That gave me a chill.
Dan,
the Amazon woman.
Yeah, yeah. Ania, go ahead. We've just got a minute left to go, Ania, but go ahead, please.
Yes, I want to add to that. I just feel like I have to say this. Like, capitalism as it exists today is untenable for the future. Like, I think there are articles,
Amen.
There are scientific studies. We are consuming more than we are, like, giving back. And, like, just the climate and the environment alone cannot sustain it. So the next decade to two decades is going to determine how much we value our own lives over money. Like, that, this is the point in history of people, that we are going to make a conscious decision about whether we care more about the things we have and our status than actually being able to survive on this planet. So it's our choice.
Ania Williams, co-founder of Zebras Unite, an organization that calls for more ethical and inclusive startup and venture capital culture, also executive director of Black and Brown Founders, and founder and CEO of Tinsel, a fashion tech company. Ania, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Dan Lyons, author of the new book Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. Dan, it was great to talk to you. Thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And ladies and gentlemen, we want to hear your work stories, so go to onpointradio.org. And let us know how work has been changing for you in the past 10 or 20 years. We've also got an excerpt of Dan Lyons' book at onpointradio.org as well. Thanks to you all for listening. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.